Woody Allen is known around the world as a writer slash director. But writer has always come first. Whatever legacy Allen leaves behind, it will be in his writing where his talent really shone through. He has a natural ability to come up with great ideas, express them in endlessly quotable lines, and wrap them all in a story that could make you laugh or cry. He learned to be a director, he learned to use his acting skills, but he was a born writer. Allen has also been prolific. He has written so many words, scenes, characters, and plots. He has written films, jokes, sketches, short stories, plays, and articles. It is in the 50 films that he wrote where he will make his biggest impact. With 3 wins and 16 Oscar nominations for screenplay, he is the most decorated screenwriter in cinema history. Through it all, he's never stood still. He's written fourth-wall-breaking, time-bending romances. He's written murder mysteries and tense thrillers. He's written mockumentaries and anthologies. And he's done it year after year after year. But what makes him so great? And how does it work? How does he work? And how has his writing changed? Well, let's have a look at all of that. Welcome to the Woody Allen Pages podcast. This week, in a special episode, we look at Woody Allen the writer. We look at what he writes, how he writes, and how his writing has changed over the years. Spoilers are everywhere, so watch the films and then come back.
Chapter 1. He adored New York City. He idolized it all out of proportion. He romanticized it all out of proportion. Better. To him, no matter what the season was, this was still a town that existed in black and white and pulsated to the great tunes of George Gershwin. Now let me start this over. Chapter 1.
Allen has always been a writer. He says that in school he was the funny one. He could always come up with a good line and a way to make someone laugh. Even Allen, who always hesitates to compliment himself, concedes that this was his talent. That he was always able to come up with a funny line the way other kids were able to draw. In fact, he was such a little joke machine that he started submitting jokes to newspapers as a teen. This was in the era when newspapers would have columnists who would write about the world of celebrities, and they needed to be witty. So the managers of these celebrities or columnists would buy jokes and credit them to their clients. They didn't really care where they came from as long as they were funny. Allen said he lucked out that being funny was his skill, because it didn't matter who he was, as long as he got a laugh, he was doing his job. He could have come from anywhere or be any age. Allen also lucked out by being so prolific. He would send in dozens of jokes a day and have dozens of new ones ready the next day. Being prolific would be a hallmark of his writing. Soon the papers knew who he was. The good thing about some of the papers was that they paid money and occasionally gave a young Allen credit. A talent agent, David O. Alber Associates, started noticing Woody Allen's name in the paper. Yes, even in those early teenage years, he was going by that name. They hired a young Woody Allen for $25 a day to write jokes. And now he was making money, and enough that he was earning more than his parents. Allen would write up to 50 jokes a day, and he would get most of it done on the train into Manhattan after school, before he ever got into the office. He would then hang around the talent agent's Madison Avenue office till around 6, just learning and reading the paper. His bosses would tell him that 50 jokes a day was too much, but he wrote that many anyway.
Chérie, what will I do with this, eh? He says, oh, Marie, sometime you make me so mad. Oh, they scream at that. Now, write me something like that, will you? Kind of a French number, can you do?
But he wanted to do more than write one-liners. He wanted to write books, like his favourite, J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, or the classics he was discovering at the time, like Tolstoy. And he was falling in love with film, in the city where there were more cinemas than any other. He wanted to have a go at writing and directing films. So Allen enrolled into a film course at NYU, but he dropped out after 2 semesters. Allen had a distant uncle named Abe Burrows who had written stories for the musicals How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying and Guys and Dolls. Burrows made some letters of introduction for Allen to comedy writers in TV. With his backlog of published jokes, Allen was accepted into the NBC Writers Program. At age 19, he moved to Los Angeles to be a proper writer. After finishing up the NBC Writers Program, Allen got to work on a couple of shows. In these TV years, he worked for the comedian Sid Caesar on shows like Your Show of Shows. Through that connection, he met and worked with people like Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, before both men became comedy legends. He also met Larry Gelbart, who would go on to create MASH and inspired Alan Alda's character in Crimes and Misdemeanors.
And what makes New York such a funny place is that there's so much tension and pain and misery and craziness here. And they got, that's the first part of comedy. But see, you got to get some distance from it. You know what I mean? That the thing to remember about comedy is if it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny. So you got to get back from the pain. See what I mean?
He also met Neil Simon, the celebrated writer of plays and films such as The Odd Couple, Barefoot in the Park, and many more. Alan would one day star in an adaptation of Neil Simon's The Sunshine Boys. Alan also met Neil's brother Danny, who was also a writer. Alan has really praised Danny Simon over the years, who guided Alan in how to craft stories and scenes. Danny Simon would spend a long time working on setup lines to make sure that they were natural. Alan learnt the importance of the setup line from Danny Simon.
Then this crazy girl who smokes opium makes up a story, and Fitzgerald plants the jewels
There's
in my apartment.
There's a word for people who think everyone is conspiring against them.
That's right, perceptive.
See,
Alan would say that these years he learnt a lot. He was working with some of the funniest men in entertainment, and maybe he could have learned to be a screenwriter and playwright like Neil Simon, but Alan's career would take a different turn.
Eugene's is moderately proud to present actor, author, comedian, and spoiler of women, Mr. Woody Allen.
Alan's managers had an idea. They could see the world was changing, and that you didn't need to be John Ford or Cary Grant to be a star. There was a new kind of film star, and people like Dustin Hoffman were leading films. Weird-looking people like Bob Dylan were icons. And at the same time, the borscht belt humour of ex-wives and airplane food were going away. People were talking about sex, therapy, politics, and life's meaning. So they said to their young client that he should put himself out there as a performer and try his hand at stand-up, and write about these new topics that the kids were into. Alan took his wit and started writing jokes for himself. And it's in these years where he found his voice. When you listen to the stand-up albums that Alan released in the mid-60s, you can hear so much of what Alan would talk about for the next several decades. There's the Jewishness. Alan would talk about rabbis and his own Jewish upbringing. There's plenty of sexual politics and jokes about dating. His references were high-minded and literate. He mentions the film Camille and people like Gertrude Stein. Alan didn't care to be mainstream.
We laughed over it. Hemingway punched me in the mouth. I remember Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald came home from their wild New Year's Eve party. It was April.
Probably the most groundbreaking was Alan's skewering of masculinity. He made fun of himself. He was a wimp, an unlucky loser, and in many ways, an insignificant man. It was a persona he played around with. He wasn't a square-jawed hero. In fact, Alan would talk about the very modern topics of therapy, analysis, and mental health. There's hypochondria and other neuroses. And Alan, like many other stand-up comics at the time, started mixing his own life in with the jokes.
I was talking about this on TV last week. I escape always into a rich fantasy life that comes from an unhappy childhood. I come from a poor family. My father worked at Coney Island. He had a concession on the boardwalk where you knock over milk bottles with baseballs, which I could never do for my entire childhood. There was a tidal wave at Coney Island when I was a child. It ripped up the boardwalk and did about $1 million worth of damage, houses and everything. The only thing left standing were those little milk bottles, you know?
But it's not just what he talked about. The punchline of bits like Eggs Benedict and The Moose is great joke writing and great storytelling. Alan paints the scene and nails the payoff.
Mr. Berkowitz is shot, stuffed, and mounted at the New York Athletic Club. And the joke is on them because it's restricted.
And there's plenty of jokes that are just weird and wonderful. It was more than just a stand-up. These are the years where Alan's star was rising. He was appearing on TV and on talk shows doing jokes. He even had his own TV special and filled in for Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. He started writing short comic pieces for publications like The New Yorker in the mid-60s. There were usually short stories that reaffirmed all the things that Alan was becoming known for. Jewishness, neurosis, intellectualism, and absurdity. Some of these pieces were outright gags, like the fake journalism pieces of A Look at Organized Crime, or fake letters or lists. But there was the start of some stories, like the play Death Knocks. Viva Vargas, another early story, was essentially a draft for Bananas. And with his grind reputation, he got his first film job, writing 1965's What's New Pussycat. That film, with its much-publicised madness, was another outlet for Alan's jokes. But it wasn't a proper script that Alan was asked to write, and he constantly wrote new scenes after new scenes. Similarly, What's New Tiger Lily, a film created by Alan and his friends when they took two existing Japanese spy films, cut them together and dubbed new jokes, was not really a script. He had still yet to write a proper long-form film.
I've never heard of that being done before, where the actors would be acting one story and saying another.
It was, actually. It was done in Gone with the Wind. Not many people know that. Those are Japanese people, actually, and we dubbed in American voices on that, with Southern voices.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Then there was his first ever plays. Alan had contributed jokes to other plays, but his first produced play was 1966's Don't Drink the Water. It was about a family, much like Alan's own, who gets trapped in an embassy behind the Iron Curtain. It was successful without being a hit. It allowed Alan to write another one, 1969's Play It Again, Sam, which featured Alan, Diane Keaton, and Tony Roberts. The clever romantic comedy really showed off what Alan could do and how there was an audience for his work. The film rights for both Don't Drink the Water and Play It Again, Sam were sold. Alan had no input on the first, but he wrote the screenplay for the second and finally managed to get the producers to let him star as well. Alan hated the 1969 film of Don't Drink the Water. He had nicer things to say about 1972's Play It Again, Sam, but he says very clearly that it is not his film or his vision. The only way to do that was to write, direct, and control everything. And that would come in 1969 with his first film, Take the Money and Run, and then 49 more films after that. So let's have a look at how he's written those films.
It threw me out because I was not interested in college. You know, I wanted to be a writer. That's all I cared about was writing. I did not care about the real world. I cared only about the world of fiction. And you know, plus I tried to give the dean's wife an enema, so they didn't take kindly to that. But, you know.
How Alan starts a film changes all the time. That spark can come from many places. But what seemed to be constant is that he has plenty of ideas ready to go. For many decades, Alan has said he has never had writer's block. There's Alan's infamous drawer of ideas. Alan has a drawer with scrap papers where he scribbles things down and keeps them. When he needs something, he thumbs through the drawer for film ideas, scene ideas, scraps of dialogue, or just inspiration. Alan also has some ideas what's in there. He has a separate note of ideas that he wants to do next, which is the best of these scraps of paper. Some ideas stay in the drawer for decades before they ever get made. In the early 90s, Alan asked Douglas McGrath to write with him and presented him with five ideas to work on. These were these desk drawer ideas that had piled up that Alan wanted to get around to. Whether it's a scrap of paper or not, there's so many ways that Alan films can start. For his first film and his first few films, Alan simply chose some comedic premises. Be it crime or the future or Russia, it was a flavour and a style for Alan to add jokes. But as he developed as a writer, the more these ideas became about personal concerns, and he drew on what was around him. Films like Manhattan and Stardust Memories were Alan just wanting to say how he felt about the world. They were deeply personal, and at the centre was a protagonist that could only be a version of himself. His films were starting to show his unmistakable voice.
An idea for a short story about people in Manhattan who were constantly creating these real unnecessary neurotic problems for themselves because it keeps them from dealing with more unsolvable, terrifying problems about the universe.
There are films that are his personal view of the world, but then there's others where he played around with autobiography. Alan will say that films like Annie Hall or Hannah and the Sisters are not autobiographical, but some, like Radio Days or Anything Else, clearly are. Yes, they are fictionalized and the names are changed, but they are stories only he could write, about things that happened just to him. He also pulled from stories that he heard from around. There was an incident where an older couple got divorced and the mother committed suicide. Alan heard about it and it was the starting point for 1978's Interiors. 2013's Blue Jasmine was based on a woman that his wife Sun Yi knew. 2015's Irrational Man came from a court case that Alan heard about. The scene where someone is trying to pitch a script to Leonardo DiCaprio's character in Celebrity whilst he's having a breakup actually happened to Johnny Depp.
Really? Well, you know, I don't want to be pushy, but, I have a screenplay which I've written, and it occurred to me today that it might be just, you know, really perfect for you.
Yeah?
Really, yeah. I mean, right now it's a vehicle for a man, but, you know, it occurred to me that it could so easily be rewritten for a woman, and
What's it about?
Because Alan has pulled from real life, people assume that it's the only thing that Alan does. But Alan is looking for good stories, and it can often just be a single idea. Sometimes it was just music, like with Manhattan or Sweet and Lowdown. Or a jokey premise, like the simple ideas at the heart of Small Time Crooks or Midnight in Paris. Often, he's working on several ideas at once. Sometimes he will take a discarded idea that is decades old and finally come up with a way to finish it. He sat on what would be The Purple Rose of Cairo for many years, unfinished, until he realised he could have the real actors show up. If Alan's starting point changes all the time, well, there's another factor that helps Alan choose his next film that has nothing to do with inspiration, which is he likes to do something different from his last film. Over the course of Alan's career, you can see him decide on a story because it would be something new from what he's done in the last year. The small, one-set drama of September's came after the huge production of Radio Days. Sweet and Lowdown, a small, downbeat film, came after the huge Celebrity. Something light like Alice or Magic in the Moonlight followed something more intense like Another Woman or Blue Jasmine. He has a career of 50 films, so there have been exceptions, but on the whole, Alan likes to stay restless. No matter how a film starts, it has to be populated with characters. And how Alan has written characters has changed a lot over the years as well. In his early films, there was arguably only one character, Woody Allen. In his first several films, he played versions of himself. He surrounded himself with clichés more than characters. The characters in early films like Bananas are just stock characters that serve the bit, like the cartoonish dictator or the funny characters from the courtroom scene. That changed when Diane Keaton came into his life. He wrote better roles for her on Sleeper and Love and Death, but this was what Alan was hoping to do anyway. He had written her in a good role in Played Again, Sam, and had written other films that were not so comedic that he was ready to make. But really, it was with Annie Hall that Alan created his first really great character. Annie herself was so carefully drawn with her unique style and character contradictions. Yes, a lot of it was based on Diane Keaton, but Alan managed to capture that essence in his script. Keaton won the Academy Award for her role as Annie, and Alan became renowned for writing women.
I think you're pretty lucky I came along.
Oh, really? Well, la-di-da.
La-di-da.
No one has written more lead or significant roles for women. From The Purple Rose of Cairo through to Coup de Chance, Alan constantly puts women up front. There's several films like Another Woman or Blue Jasmine where women hold the screen for pretty much the entire film. And often they are older women too, not the kind that usually get a lot of lead roles. No director has created more Academy Award winning or nominated roles for women across lead and supporting categories. Alan has stock characters that he falls back on, both men and women. He's had a few hookers as comedic aside characters or neurotic wannabe actresses, but he's also had arrogant male writers or whatever the hell Michael Rapaport plays for Alan, who is hilarious and too dumb to live. But it is those lead characters. The last great one was Ginny in 2017's Wonder Wheel. She's needy, she's flawed, and she lies, but she's lonely and we feel for her. There is so much in that one character, and that character is essentially the film.
You always think a person's tragedy is their own fault?
No.
Then there's the opposite of those intense character films. There are the ensembles. Alan got so confident with characters that he was happy to put a film together with several dozen of them. Starting with Interiors and up to 2012's To Rome With Love, there are sometimes no clear leads in Alan's films. There are so many memorable small roles, like the idiot gang in Small Time Crooks or Alan Alda's arrogant character from Crimes and Misdemeanors. There's been Devils, Sperm, The Grim Reaper and F. Scott Fitzgerald. So many of Alan's films show off the starry ensemble in the poster, and they all have something interesting to do. Just look at Diane Wiest, who is so acclaimed for her work with Alan, but has never actually been in the lead. And you can see the range of characters that she got to play. There's almost no character as real in Alan's career as Holly in Hannah and Her Sisters. But there's also nothing less real than the diva Helen Sinclair in Bullets Over Broadway.
Hey, folks, what can I get you?
2 martinis, please. Very dry.
How do you know what I drank?
Oh, you want 1, 2? 3.
3 martinis.
Interestingly, Alan has said that his characters have no life outside the film. Many actors over the years have asked Alan about character motivations. He has joked that it's the paycheck. There's no information about where they are from, where they went to school, or anything for an actor to build on. Alan doesn't think about what happens to the characters after the film is ended. The answer is on the page. For some actors, it's an opportunity to come up with something. For Alan, all that matters is making the page work. Everything else is nonsense.
What should I be thinking inside?
Think laxative.
Think soothing relief.
Over the decades, Alan moved from writing about himself to more ensembles and women. Similarly, he moved from comedy to more dramatic work. He took detours in between, and it wasn't always easy. One of the oddest films in Alan's body of work is 2004's Melinda and Melinda. The film took a story that Alan had in mind and he made 2 versions, the comedy and the drama. The film was essentially an argument over the merits of comedy over drama. In his writing, Alan has struggled with the same question for a decade. He's had plenty of ideas where he played around with it as a comedy and as a drama. It might sound strange, but Alan took ideas like the murderer at the heart of a rational man and tried it as a comedy before making it a drama. Alan took the eavesdropping idea from another woman and made it comedic in Everyone Says I Love You. The working class family with the successful uncle was an idea that Alan used for the tense Cassandra's dream and then for romantic purposes in Cafe Society. For Alan, plot and characters are one thing. The genre of comedy and drama sit on top of that.
Look, you guys, what are we discussing here? Is there a deeper reality in comedy or tragedy? Who can even make such a judgment?
Look, let me tell you.
Alan, of course, started with comedies. His comedy instinct was honed in his days as a comedy writer and a stand-up. By the time he was making films, he had an array of comedic tricks up his sleeve. The most obvious is how Alan filled his films with thousands of memorable one-liners and gags. Hundreds of jokes about God, therapy, California, Jewishness, masculinity, dying, and more. Often, Alan's characters say a joke and no one laughs. It's just a little joke between the character and the audience. After a while, he got really great at mixing humour with meaning. Like Danny Simon taught him, the jokes had to serve a purpose. There's so many great lines to choose from, but just look at the ones that have become part of the culture. Like I need the eggs, dead sharks, if it bends it's funny, and don't speak. The dichotomy of Alan's dialogue is that he's open to improvisation, but most actors are afraid to go off script, especially when the words were written by Woody Allen. He told the Entourage and Celebrity that they were just friends and they can say whatever they want in their casino scene, and they stuck word for word to Woody Allen's script. He famously told Paul Simon, during Annie Hall, to just come up with a way to invite Annie and Alvy to a party and use the word mellow somehow. To that, Alan had a joke ready to go.
I'm just not, you know, I don't think I could take a mellow eve because I don't respond well to mellow. You know, I mean, I have a tendency to, if I get too mellow, I ripen and then rot.
It's amazing that Alan, a man who treasures the writing, is so open to people changing his work. Of course, he gets final say, so if you say something bad, then you'll be cut. Alan's work in Europe often has people speak in languages he doesn't know. Vicky Cristina Barcelona's fiery arguments were all improvised by Javier Bardem and Penelope Cruz. But I think that gets to the heart of what Alan is trying to do, which is realism and people sounding natural. It's not very often that an actor puts on an accent or uses a voice in Alan films. If they do, it's played for jokes. Asked about his latest film, Coup de Chance, Alan says that you don't need to understand the words to know if the actors are getting it right. Wit is important and the characters need to be solid, but they need to live in a world, and Alan has built some pretty fun worlds. Those magical ideas are some of my favourite Woody Allen stories. The time travelling in Midnight in Paris, or the cinema characters coming to life in The Purple Rose of Cairo. Often it's magical realism, and Alan pairs the magical with the mundane. The Greek chorus that follows the characters around mighty Aphrodite's otherwise simple adoption drama fits the bill. Over and over he comes up with these what-if ideas that we love to see play out. They show Alan's wild imagination, like the out-of-focus man in Deconstructing Harry, or the opera singer in The Shower of To Roam With Love. In a way, breaking the fourth wall in Annie Hall is a bit of magical realism. Learning from comedy, Alan knew that his magical realism had to have a payoff. It's great that Gil gets to travel back to Paris of another time, but there's always another time before that, and that magical realism isn't so magical anymore. Or how the Greek chorus gets more involved in the film as Mighty Aphrodite goes along. An idea can't stay still, it has to grow and swerve and pay off. Then there's the worlds that Alan creates for drama. Wonder Wheel's Coney Island is claustrophobic and loud. Shadows and Fog's huge set is claustrophobic and dark. These aren't realities, they are film worlds. And really, so is Woody Allen's New York. A majority of Allen's films are set in New York, and it's not a reality either. It's his version of New York without the crime, and as beautiful as he sees it in his mind's eye.
One thing about New York City, you're here or you're nowhere. You cannot achieve this level of anxiety, hostility, and paranoia anywhere else. It's really exhilarating.
Alan first pivoted hard into drama with Interiors in 1987. He said for years that leading up to that he wanted to make something more dramatic. He had considered dramatic work to be sitting at the adult dinner table. But it's not as simple as comedy or drama. Alan would often make a mix, or use comedy to get his dramatic points across. Watching films like Manhattan and Hannah and Her Sisters today, they feel like light-hearted indie dramas more than comedies, except Alan's usual wit keeps the scripts fun. Crimes and Misdemeanors tells two stories, a dramatic one and a more comic one. In Alan's head, that mix was the compromise, but for audiences, the contrast made the film work. Alan would also try other genres, essentially doing the film version of a song cover. Films like Shadows and Fog and Manhattan Murder Mystery are clearly Alan taking on an existing genre, but again, he's adding his comedy and viewpoint to serious-style films to make a mixed point. Match Point was Alan's first dramatic thriller, and it shed a lot of what people knew about Woody Allen. There was no New York, for one, although the story was originally written for New York and just rewritten for London. But what felt new was the tension and murder. In the two decades since, Alan has continued to explore murder and tension. That tension has always been in his work. The scene in Match Point where Chris is setting up for his murder is incredibly tense. But so is Gil in Midnight in Paris, fumbling around in his hotel room, and we are waiting to see if he gets found out. Or Woody in the adoption office in Mighty Aphrodite looking for papers waiting to be caught. Whether it's for murder or for laughs, tension works.
Did anyone ever tell you you play a very aggressive game?
In the last couple of decades, Alan has done more to change people's perception of him as a comic writer than ever before. He's continued to write plays, and several of them, like The Floating Lightbulb and A Secondhand Memory, were family dramas with no jokes. It was a place for him to practice his dramatic writing. Alan's written people dramas like with You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger or Cafe Society, Cassandra's Dream, Blue Jasmine, Irrational Man, Wonder Wheel, and his latest, Coup de Chance, all deal with death or murder. Drama is now an accepted part of Alan's work. So much so that some critics dismissed Coup de Chance, a film with no jokes, no Woody Allen surrogates, no New York, and no English, as just the same old Woody Allen. In terms of how Alan physically works, that has almost hilariously remained unchanged over the decades. Yes, there's his legendary typewriter. But before all that, Alan writes a lot of it by hand. In fact, Alan will pretty much write his first draft completely by hand, crossing things out and stapling bits together to make sense. He wrote Crimes and Misdemeanors on various bits of stationery in different hotels whilst on a European holiday. He assembled the various scraps back in the US. But often he writes at home, and because he does it so manually, he says he gives his characters short names so he doesn't have to write them out so much. Alan has also worked with collaborators on the very odd occasion, but there's only ever been three. Mickey Rose co-wrote Alan's first two films. Mickey was Alan's high school friend who stayed friends with Alan and helped him write some stand-up. He would go on to work on a lot of comedy TV. Marshall Brickman wrote four, including Annie Hall and Manhattan. He wrote for TV talk shows and played in a jazz band that Alan later joined. He would go into directing, but he would get his biggest success for writing the book for the Jersey Boys musical. Douglas McGraw co-wrote one, Bullets Over Broadway, in 1994. He worked on Saturday Night Live and also saw success in musicals, writing the book for the Carole King musical, Beautiful. He also acted and appeared in many of Alan's films. Alan doesn't really choose collaborators to help him change or do anything different. All his co-writers were existing friends with some writing experience. When he collaborates with people, they would talk and discuss the script, sometimes over long walks in Central Park, but it was always Alan who would come home and write it down. With writing, he uses an Olympia portable typewriter that he's had since he was 16. He tried a computer word processor once and hated it. He had trouble finding parts and places to repair the typewriter. But nowadays, with the world having found a place for old record players and vintage cameras, it has become easier than ever to maintain his typewriter. Alan types his drafts together and still uses scissors and staples to insert scenes together if needed. The first stop after that is his longtime producer Helen Robin, who types it up with traditional screenwriting software, and then that's the master version. But not many people get to see it. Alan is very secretive about his scripts.
I'm not a technology guy.
I hate technology.
I know. I could tell by looking at you. I still work on one of those old-fashioned antique portable typewriters.
Of course, that's usually not the end of it. Even in his first film, Take the Money and Run, Alan had to rewrite and reshoot the film because it wasn't working. This has been a part of Alan's process ever since. It seems these days that reshoots are a dirty word. The idea of reshoots suggests that the film is in trouble and needs to be salvaged. But for Alan, he required actors and crew to be available for reshoots from the start. He knows that he will change things. Alan has brutally written out complete sections of his films. A whole segment of Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex was discarded. It featured Louise Lasser as a massive spider who killed her lover like some spiders do. It was shot at great expense and now it's just gone. Entire characters and subplots have been lost. Viggo Mortensen in The Purple Rose of Cairo, Daryl Hannah in Crimes and Misdemeanors, Liv Tyler in Everyone Says I Love You. There's many more. Those characters were just excised after production. Bruce Willis was initially hired for a role in Cafe Society. He shot scenes, but he wasn't able to do the lines. We now know he had health problems, but the end result was that he had to be recast, ultimately with Steve Carell. But Alan had lost the California locations that featured Willis, and the whole film had to be rewritten after production had started, with scenes that could be shot in New York. But Alan was able to write around it. All these reshoots, I think, come from Alan's view that the story is king. Even if the scene had been shot with great expense, if the words and the ideas aren't working, then it has to go. If it needs to be rewritten, then he rewrites it. Whether it's on his trusty typewriter or going out to New York streets to shoot it all again.
That's the most disgusting story I ever heard.
Titles get rewritten too. Alan often leaves it to the last minute to finalise a film's title. Famously, Annie Hall was originally called Anhedonia, and no one knew what the hell Alan was on about. Similarly, he wanted to call his Italian film The Bob Cameron, but was talked into changing it to the much more likeable To Rome With Love. Crimes and Misdemeanors was once called Brothers, The Rational Man was once called Crazy Abe, Cafe Society was called Dorfman, a novel. But part of the film that Alan has rewritten the most is endings. He rewrote the ending of Take the Money and Run and many of his early films. He got better at writing endings from the start, but how the film ends still obsesses him, and probably every other screenwriter. Annie Hall's ending was written in a cab on the way to the editing bay, having struggled with the ending for weeks. Hannah and her sister's happy ending, where it is revealed that Diane Wiest's character is pregnant, is something that Alan has said he regretted. He didn't change and rewrite that one. Alan thought he delivered the cheap, happy ending, and after that, he vowed not to do so ever again.
Make a great story, I think. Guy marries one sister, doesn't work out. Then years later, he winds up married to the other sister. It's, you know, it's a, I don't know how you're going to top that.
What? I'm pregnant.
It plays to his desire to make sure his films have deeper meaning. For the man who could always make someone laugh and who enjoyed writing comedy because of the simplicity of getting a laugh or not, he spent decades looking for more difficult ground. And in recent years, with films like Blue Jasmine, Rational Man, and Coup de Chance, bitter endings seem to be what Alan wants to leave you with. In 2024, the time of the writing of this, we have no idea where Alan's writing will go next. But in every interview, he says he's still writing. Films, plays, and short stories. He has said many times that if he can't get a film deal, he'll just become a writer and give up directing. He has already written so much. He is the most accomplished and most prolific writer in American cinema history. He has those plays, books, memoirs, and jokes. But there's one thing he's never written, and it's a thing that he wants to do, and that's to write the novel. We know Allen has at least a couple of goes at it. He had one novel at least close to finished in the early 70s, which he was unhappy with, that he sent to friends, and he later turned some parts into anything else. It sounds like what became Cafe Society was a novel at one point. He has also talked about writing a novel in many interviews. In Crisis in Six Scenes and Rifkin's Festival, the character's regret is not writing a great novel. Allen's last collection of short stories, Zero Gravity, featured his longest short story yet, one that took up almost a third of the collection. It's called Growing Up in Manhattan. In that story, his prose is as sharp as ever. He knows how to paint a picture with words. And it's not a funny piece. It feels like it could have been expanded into a novel, but it remains a short story. I don't know if Allen even has the idea. Allen wants to write a novel for the sake of writing a novel. The great American novel. It's the greatest form for a writer, and still the last challenge for Allen. He wrote his long-form memoir, and he has plenty of films that felt like novels, but the novel itself eludes him. Allen winding back his film work allowed him to publish his long-awaited memoir, which took decades to write. And maybe he'll finally finish that novel now. We'll have to wait and see what he's working on.
What happened to that book you were touring with?
It just kind of floated away.
Charles Dickens apparently created 3,600 named or identified characters in his life. That's an incredible number. But if you take Allen's 50 films, with an average about 50 or so characters each, and that includes every small speaking role or character part, plus his plays, short stories, short films, and stories told in sketches, I reckon Allen is definitely in the 3,000s. And that's his legacy. The things that he made up, rather than the things that he made and shot with a camera. Those thousands of characters and thousands of jokes and thousands of great lines. All those incredible beginnings, tense middles, and difficult endings. All those stories that he's given us. When Allen was a teenager, he was told he wrote more than was needed, and he did it anyway. And I reckon he still has time to make up the difference on Dickens, and maybe even by some margin.
Should I just chuck my book and go back to teaching movies?
I would, unless you want to end up with 500 pages of turgid whining.
That's it. It's been a busy year for me, and it's been a quiet year for Woody, but the podcast will continue and the website as well. Remember, if you want to help the podcast, there's a few ways. There's the Patreon. There's also the Buy Me a Coffee tipping service. There's bits of merch that you can buy, such as our Woody Allen film guide books and posters or t-shirts of our podcast artwork. You can find all the links in the description. There's also no-cost ways of supporting me, like leaving a review and just telling your friends. And of course, there'll be links in the description to the website and to us on social media. But for now, there'll be more podcasts in 2025. In the season ahead, there will be 10 more films, including the new Coup de Chance, some big films that I've been deliberately saving, and another special episode. Fingers crossed that 2025 turns out to be a busy year for Woody Allen as well. We know he's been writing, he has a play coming out, and there was talk of another film. Hopefully it all works out, because Coup de Chance actually did quite well. There might well be a 51st film that I'll need to cover before this podcast wraps. Until then, thanks once again for listening.
So Brandon tells me you're his writer.
Well, you know, I'm a writer.
I write. I wrote some film scripts.
Really?
Have you ever heard of Chekhov?
I have.
I write like him.
You write like him?